Welcome to Deconstructed. I'm TJ O'Hara, the principal political analyst for IVN, the Independent Voter News. Our goal on Deconstructed is to break down important political issues with outstanding guests so you can develop your own more informed opinion. My guest today is Suja A. Thomas, professor of law at the University of Illinois College of Law. She has done substantive research in the areas of civil procedure, discrimination law, the right to a jury trial, and the theories of constitutional interpretation. Professor Thomas has published a plethora of scholarly articles and is the author of several books, among them one entitled Unequal, How America's Courts Undermine Discrimination Law, which she co-authored with Sandra Sperino, professor of law at the University of Cincinnati, who's a mutual friend and a former guest on this show. Given today's interest in stemming the tide of racial and sexual injustice, among other suspect categories, Professor Thomas is here to provide us with a fresh and informative perspective with respect to the current state of discrimination law. And with that, welcome to Deconstructed, Suja.
Thank you so much for having me.
Suja, allow me to congratulate you on your book, Unequal. It provides a stunning and somewhat disturbing view of discrimination law in the United States. To set the tone, give us an example of the types of cases that you review in that book.
One of the cases that I often mention is a case that there was a sexual harassment alleged by a deputy sheriff against her supervisor in the sheriff's department. And there were a lot of alleged activity, including that the supervisor tried to kiss her after a Christmas party and called her a name when she refused. He showed up at places she was staking out and kind of referred to her about what she was wearing, what she looked like. He peered even on her driveway and told her son how he loved her. He commented on her behind. He said he would have a very favorable reaction if she walked into the room. He rubbed up against her. He picked her up over his head in the office. He asked her over the phone if she was dressed or naked. I could go on and on and on, and there was a complaint filed that included all of this information plus much, much more, and the trial court said there isn't enough evidence of sexual harassment. Over 4 years, there were only 16 instances, and most of the time it was just things that he said, not touching or attempting touching, and it was really horseplay. It wasn't that frequent. And the case was dismissed, and the plaintiff did not get a chance to have a jury decide. And the appellate court heard it, and it also said, yes, we're going to affirm the dismissal. And so this is one example of many that we have in our book where cases are dismissed by judges and we don't have a jury of our peers able to decide these cases.
We'll talk about what allows dismissals like that to take place and what kind of pushes that through the judicial system in the next segment. But right now, help our audience understand, what are the three federal laws that serve as the cornerstone protections against employment discrimination?
Sure. So one of the laws, Title VII, is a part of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So we had protection against discrimination in employment, discrimination in voting, discrimination in public accommodations, some of the protections. And so Title VII is protection against discrimination in employment. And it includes various categories, race discrimination, sex discrimination, religious discrimination. But some categories were not covered. And another law that was enacted after that is the Age Discrimination in Employment Act, and that covers people who are 40 and above. And there is another law called the American Disabilities Act, and that also was enacted sometime after Title VII, actually in the 90s, and that protects people against discrimination on the basis of a disability.
Now, Title VII has rather broad language and covers the widest bandwidth of categories, but not everyone is covered, are they?
Yeah, not everyone is covered. In a smaller business, let's say five people in the company, that employer will not be covered. It also is the case that if you're not considered an employee, So if you're what is called an independent contractor, then you may not also be covered under Title VII. So there are various categories of people that are not covered under Title VII.
And a lot of people are under the assumption that Title VII and discrimination acts under that can be used to go after deep pockets, if you will, in the corporate world. Is that true or are there caps?
There are caps. So for example, Title VII has caps in it based on how many employees a company has. And Title VII, as you said, it covers a broad set of categories. Section 1981 is another statute that's available for race discrimination. That actually doesn't have caps, but for the most part, there are limitations. I'll also say, though, just as a little caveat, that some of the state laws don't have caps on them. But I think your point is to say that there are some limitations that are already set forth in some statutes.
Now, let's take a look at an example like that one that you described. If the female officer wants to go to trial, what are the steps that she has to go through? Because it's not just as easy as saying, well, I'm going to file a lawsuit.
Right. So it's so interesting, I think, that employment discrimination law is so different than, for example, if you have an accident on the street in your car. That case can be brought immediately, that personal injury case. On the other hand, an employment discrimination case, that case actually has to be filed with an agency. There are different work sharing agreements, but you may have to file with the EEOC, the federal agency, or a state agency that does employment. And there's a period of time that they may consider it, although they're very overworked and oftentimes don't have the resources to actually even do anything with the case. So you have to go through a hurdle of actually an administrative body before you can even file a case in the federal courts or sometimes even in the state courts.
And once you bring a case to trial, let's say you had approval to bring this to trial, you have other hurdles. Can you speak to those?
Oftentimes, I think when we think about bringing a case in court, we think, okay, we'll bring the case and we'll have the jury decide, you know, the body from the community decide our case. And it makes us feel good that people from the community will decide that we were wronged, or at least we get a chance to tell them that. And that's kind of a thing that people don't realize, that there are all these steps in the process that can get in the way of a jury actually hearing your case. And so, first of all, after a complaint is filed, an employer in an employment discrimination case can say, okay, I think this case should be dismissed. I don't think this is plausible. And as a result, the judge on the case dismissed this case. And if that case is dismissed, it may be that you can file an amended complaint, but ultimately, a judge can dismiss that case at that early point in time and dismiss it with prejudice, and then you're done. That's it. So that's one point in time that the case could actually be dismissed before the case goes to a jury. If you get through that point in time, then you exchange information. That is, the employer you can ask the employer for information about what you allege about discrimination. The employer can ask you for information about what you have. You can, they're what called depositions of people, asking questions of those. And at the end of that, there's a motion, a request to the court often that is made called summary judgment. And the employer will say to the court, I think you should find for us. And they say, I think a reasonable jury would not find for the plaintiff. And that's what happened in that case I mentioned at the beginning. An employer said to the judge on the case, I don't think a reasonable jury could find sexual harassment. And the judge on the case said, right, I think that's right. A reasonable jury couldn't find sexual harassment. And then when the case went to the appellate court agreed. So that's another point in time that is summary judgment before trial. And if that wasn't enough, if you actually get through that hurdle, then you go to trial and you present evidence before a jury, and let's say the jury finds for you. At that point in time, the employer can say to the judge, I think the jury should have found for us. a reasonable jury couldn't have found for the plaintiff if the plaintiff won. And again, the judge can say, yeah, I think the plaintiff should have won. I find for you, the employer. So those are a few of the procedures, and there are even more of them that can stand in the way of someone actually having their case heard by a jury.
And even after the jury trial, and let's say you win, there could be a new trial. Or in lieu of a new trial, the judge could issue an order of remittiture, which would reduce the amount of damages by whatever he or she feels is excessive. And beyond that, appeal, which just costs additional time and money for the plaintiff, even if they make it through. So, Suja, we're going to take a quick break and talk more about the formidable challenges of winning a discrimination suit when we come back. Welcome back. My guest is Suja A. Thomas, professor of law at the University of Illinois College of Law and co-author of Unequal, How America's Courts Undermine Discrimination Law. Suja, you were giving us examples of the hurdles that you have to get through just from a pragmatic standpoint in the judicial process. And you gave us a wonderful example of a case that's almost impossible to rationalize how it could be dismissed. But let's talk about discrimination and the various different doctrines and inferences. Can you explain the adverse action doctrine?
Sure. So I think most of us can think that if there were a case that was out there, that if someone were fired and they alleged that they were fired because of their sex, that that's a case that because they were fired because of their sex, that they should be able to bring a case alleging that and getting damages for that if that is proven. So the courts have talked about that firing as an adverse action, an example of an adverse action. And so there are other types of actions that courts will say are not sufficiently serious to constitute adverse action. So, for example, you might imagine, and this happens, right, in workplaces, that if someone were to discriminate against someone, they might not fire someone, but they might put them in a bad office, they might give them a negative evaluation, they might do something else. And what the courts have said over and over is that they have taken these other types of actions that are not hiring or firing, things that we would think, of course, fall into that category. But I think a lot of us would think if someone were to give us a negative evaluation or were to put us in an office because of our sex, that that should be actionable, that if someone were to do that, I should be able to recover damages for that. I should be able to sue and recover damages. And courts will say, no, that's not serious enough. And so this is an example of what we think that's a case that should go to a jury. A jury should decide whether the discrimination occurred, one, and two, how much a person should get in terms of damages if they think discrimination occurred.
Now, you mentioned severity, and the courts have to consider a number of different issues. What are the issues that are on the table for the court to consider as to whether there's discrimination or not? I'm thinking along the lines of the frequency of the alleged discrimination, severity, physical threatening versus humiliation, so forth.
Sure. And so it depends on what we're talking about. So, for example, if we're talking about the case that I mentioned at the beginning, that is a sexual harassment case or a racial harassment case, there are these frameworks that courts have set up in discrimination cases, and they have said you have to satisfy this framework in order for the case to get to a jury. So in the example that I used at the beginning, the courts have said that when we're talking about sexual harassment, we have to look at whether or not the action is severe or pervasive to alter the employment terms or conditions and create a hostile or abusive working environment. So in theory, that sounds interesting, right? That maybe, okay, maybe that should be the standard in theory. But if we actually look at the language of the statute, which you kind of referred to at the beginning of the podcast, the language of the discrimination statute, it's very broad. It tells us that you shouldn't discriminate against a person because of their race or their sex. And if someone is sexually harassed by someone, it seems to be, to me, that they're being treated differently because of their sex, even if someone were to say that it's not severe or it's not pervasive. And so this is a criticism that the Supreme Court has set up the standard and made it almost impossible to say that there was sexual harassment. So if we look back at the case that I mentioned at the beginning, having someone try to kiss someone, actually hold them above their head, make comments that are sexual in nature, you know, touching them, this should be sexual harassment. Of course, that's going to get in the way of someone doing their job. And outside of that is going to be incredibly, possibly emotionally damaging to someone. So the courts have set up these frameworks, and that's one example in the harassment context, that are incredibly difficult to withstand, and therefore courts are saying, okay, we're going to dismiss these cases.
Can you touch upon quickly the stray remarks doctrine? Because I find that to be almost absurd.
So the stray remarks doctrine is used a lot by courts to say that remarks that are discriminatory are essentially irrelevant. So an example would be if an employer will use a derogatory term towards the employee, and that will happen in January. And then in June, the employee is fired by that particular person. And the courts will say, well, they made that derogatory comment in January, and they fired this person in June. And there was discrimination in January, but you can't say there was discrimination in June. It was a remark made in January. It has nothing to do with what happened in June. And the 6 month, you know, period might be a little short, but certainly they'll do that when there's a little bit longer of a period of time in between, and they'll say, yeah, this is a stray remark, and we can't say that there was discrimination, and we're going to disregard that derogatory racial remark.
The judicial framework that's been set up, driven somewhat through the Supreme Court, if there's direct evidence, the case won't be dismissed. But if there's only circumstantial evidence, my word versus your word and so forth, very quickly, what's the process? What do you have to prove as the plaintiff? What do I have to do as the employer? And then is there anything else you can do if I get past my hurdle?
So this is referred to as the McDonnell-Douglas test, and there's been a lot of criticism of this test. It was established in the 70s. And again, this is very unique to employment discrimination law. You don't really have these frameworks set up in most other areas of the law. And then they end up preventing cases from going to juries. And so in an employment discrimination case, what you'll have is the employee will have to say, okay, to prove the prima facie case to the court, and that is that they were in a protected class, there was adverse circumstances, that they were qualified for the position in the first instance, and there are circumstances indicating discrimination. So they have to show that to the court, and then the employer can then say, well, I have a legitimate non-discriminatory reason why let's say it's a firing, and this is the reason the person didn't come to work on time. And that's it. Like, there's not like a whole lot to that. They just have to offer one. You know, this is a very low burden on the employer. And then the employee, the lawyer, will present evidence that the employer's reason was pretext or a cover-up for discrimination. And so then the employee has to present all kinds of facts to try to show that the employer is just making this up. And the thing that I think is interesting about this, that most people don't understand if you're not a lawyer doing this type of work, is that this is all paper that's presented to a judge. So all of this is described on paper, and then the judge makes a decision as to whether or not they think a reasonable jury could find that, you know, there was discrimination. So you don't have witnesses talking to the judge, so that you could, you know, assess their credibility. It's just this paper record. So I think it's a pretty formidable task for a judge, but even though I think it's a formidable task, judges dismiss a huge percentage of these cases, and I'll throw out the statistic. There's a Federal Judicial Center study that showed that over 70% of these cases are dismissed in full or in part. So most of these cases are dismissed in summary judgment.
Well, Suja, we're going to take another quick break and talk more about discrimination cases and what can be done when we come back. Welcome back. My guest is Suja A. Thomas, a professor of law at the University of Illinois College of Law and co-author of Unequal, How America's Courts Undermine Discrimination Law. Suja, you know, at the end of the last segment, you talked about 70% of the cases being dismissed. Why are these cases being dismissed that early in the process and never allowing this to get to jury?
I think that it's a hard question to definitively say why, but I certainly have some opinions as to why more cases do not go to juries. And I think if we look at who's deciding whether or not the case goes to a jury, in the federal courts and the state courts have matched the federal courts in some way in terms of composition, we have a lot of people who look the same, that there's a lot of male judges, and there are a lot of white judges. And as much as we all would like to think that we can decide something, it would be, and we would have the same opinion as some other person, we all have different experiences and perspectives. And because of those differences in experiences and perspectives, we may have a different opinion. And that's why we could decide that I like a movie or you don't like a movie. We do have different perspectives. And the same goes for something like discrimination. And so that's why the beautiful thing about a jury is that you have a set of people from the community who together decide, mostly unanimously in most jurisdictions, that there has been discrimination or there has not been discrimination. And what we now have in our system is, especially in the federal courts, we have the system where one person, and usually that person is white, and usually that person is male, deciding whether they think a reasonable jury could find discrimination. And I might have a different opinion than that person. I might. And that's why factually intensive cases should go to juries. That's, you know, our opinion. At the end of the day, in each of these cases that we describe in the book, including the first one that I mentioned today, we're not saying that you should agree that this is discrimination or even that we're saying it's discrimination. We're just saying this case should go to a jury. A jury should decide this case because it's factually intensive.
Now, assuming the courts would move away from the frameworks that they use and allow the cases to move forward, what can Congress do as well? Is there anything that they can do from a standpoint of law?
Sure. There was some movement on this. When the Me Too movement was starting out, there was some movement by Congress to, for example, get rid of that standard that the Supreme Court set up, the severe and pervasive standard. And so that's one example. I think that Congress should step up and get rid of and explicitly say that the language of the statute is broad and that the courts need to interpret the statute as the language is, and that is broadly. And so as a result, let's not use these frameworks and doctrines like the severe pervasive doctrine, the stray remarks doctrine. There's a number of other ones that we mentioned in the book, like the same actor doctrine. So Congress itself can explicitly say, let's use the broad language of the statute courts, and let's not use these doctrines. So that's one thing that can happen. And then the courts themselves can be more open-minded about what the language says. They can say, okay, we have this statute. To the extent the Supreme Court hasn't directed us to do something, we can look to the statutory language and broadly interpret the statute. And I think that the more, like, you know, podcasts like this occur, the public can know about these problems and kind of speak out to legislators and say, hey, we think this is important and these cases should be going to juries.
Great suggestions. Suja, in the limited amount of time we have left, where can our listeners go to learn more about you and pick up a copy of your book?
Sure. The book is available on Amazon, and if you would like any information about some of my work, you can look at my website, and that's sujathomas.com. It's S-U-J-A Thomas, T-H-O-M-A-S.com.
Excellent. Well, Suja, kudos to you and your colleague, Professor Sperino, for providing such a well-researched overview of the impediments that have surfaced relative to successfully addressing discrimination in the workplace. I think many people embrace the myth that discrimination suits have gone too far, that there are often frivolous suits focused on exploiting deep pockets. Your book shows that the opposite may be true, and that the law as administered is truly unequal, as your book's title suggests. Thank you for sharing your insights, Suja, and thank you for joining me on Deconstructed.
Thank you so much for having me.